Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
If you go back in time, and we are talking about circa 1947, after the Second World War, and when the war Europe is rebuilding itself and whatnot, the U.S. and Europe and some countries in Asia, but was pretty much the U.S. and some of the countries that nowadays are the European Union, had this general agreement on trade and tariff. That's sort of the grandfather of the WTO, the World Trade Organization. So,
Kansas State Ag Economics Professor Nelson Valoria.
You had excessively high levels of protection. And when they start, and we're talking about the average across products, so it's an average, it was, talking about high levels of protection, was around 22%.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Cattle placements, they didn't appear to be affected by the previous import restrictions we've seen on live cattle from Mexico due to New World screwworm. The pace of border crossings, it's picked up here in the last few weeks, and imports of feeder cattle from Mexico, they're getting closer to historical averages for this time of year, but they're still a little below average.
That's USDA livestock analyst Anthony Fisher looking at Fed cattle marketings in the cattle on feed report.
We look at the marketing numbers, specifically the number of cattle on feed over 150 days. This is a marker that illustrates how fast cattle are being marketed, and this number continues to grow. It's well above a year ago in absolute terms, as well as a percent of the number of cattle on feed. This is also reflected in heavier dressed weights of slaughtered cattle. Feedlots, they continue to sell fed cattle at record high prices. This underscores their willingness to pay higher prices for feeder animals. The price of feeder steers weighing between 750 and 800 pounds sold at Oklahoma stockyards. This is a number that we track. It averaged about $283 per hundredweight in March. This was up 12% from a year ago. It was a record high price for the series, and it's steadily risen for the last 6 to 9 months. Part of what's driving that price increase is the current Fed cattle price, which is very strong. In March, the Fed cattle price averaged nearly $208 per hundredweight. This is also a record high price for the five area steers that we track, and it's up 11% from a year ago.
Dr. Mark Jekinowski is chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board, looks at trade and domestic use for dairy.
In terms of dairy products, we reduced our import forecast for fat basis products by 400 million pounds, and that reflects in part the tariff applied to butter coming from the EU, so that's lower butter imports. And then skim solids basis exports, we lowered by 3 billion pounds, and that's primarily lower exports of whey and non-fat dry milk, recognizing that China is a big market for whey from the U.S., and there are retaliatory tariffs in place there. And with those lower exports, we have higher domestic availability of those products on a skim solids basis.
We do watch the forecast for product, class, and all milk prices. Jekinowski explains.
In terms of dairy prices, cheese prices, we lowered 2 cents per pound to $1.79 per pound. Butter is down 7 cents per pound, $2.45. Non-fat dry milk, we reduced 3 cents per pound to $1.22. And dry whey, we reduced a penny a pound to 51 cents per pound. So prices are down, but they're off of relatively high prices historically, so still relatively strong from a long-term historic perspective. And with the lower product prices, that has a direct impact on class prices and the all milk price. So the class 3 price was lowered 35 cents per hundredweight to $17.60. Class 4 is down 60 cents per hundredweight to $18.20. And the all milk price, we lowered 50 cents per hundredweight. It is now at $21.10 per hundredweight.
And finally, USDA out with their annual hemp report. All industrial hemp in 2024. The value in the open and under protection for the U.S., $445 million. It's up 40% from 2023. Planted area for industrial hemp, 45,294 acres, up 64% from the previous year. Top five states planting hemp, tied for fourth, Kentucky and Oklahoma with 2,700 acres. Number three, California at 3,150, South Dakota, number two at 3,900, Texas at 4,900. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So a tariff, it's fundamentally a tax imposed by the government on the imported goods and or services.
Nelson Valoria is a Kansas State Ag Economics professor.
When you apply a tariff to all the goods that are imported entering the U.S., the prices will go up. And when prices go up, demand goes down, right? When you have few goods in the market, the prices go up. And that's what raises prices domestically. So you have the imports coming in, you put a tax on them, you make more expensive, you raise the domestic price, and all the prices domestically are going to increase. So as this happens, consumers are going to consume less of that good, and for whatever they are consuming, they're going to pay more. The government takes some of that, and we'll talk about that as government revenue, as tariff revenue, and the rest. And what happens is that you have a transfer from consumers to producers, and that's why tariff increase production. Basically, you are increasing the price, you are making domestic production more competitive, and it's a transfer. So what we need to keep in mind about this transfer is that it's not free. So if you are putting a tariff of 10%, prices go up by 10%, consumers are going to pay more for that tariff. Part goes to the government, part goes to producer, but an important part of that money just vanishes in the economy. Why? Because you are consuming less than you would consume otherwise. You are basically having to spend more money than you would otherwise on those same goods, and you probably are cutting your expenditures somewhere else. On the production side, we have inefficiency losses. So we are very good at producing soybeans, let's say. If we distract those resources to produce something that we are not as good, that we need protection, so that's a loss in efficiency, and those losses are not recovered by the economy. So those are the basic economics of a tariff.
What about retaliatory tariffs?
What happens with tariff is that when you impose them in another country, those countries are going to retaliate, it's a trade war. That's a technical term, trade war. So recall that we discussed at the beginning the idea that if you have a lot of a market share on a product, you would like to apply tariff to that product because you can push a lot of those costs onto the foreign producers. And that's the thing with retaliatory tariff. The retaliatory tariff that we saw in 2018 applied by China to the U.S., where in things like soybeans, where they are, or corn, or other agricultural products where they have very large market shares, and then by doing so, they are also paying more. So just as our consumers are being harmed by that tariff. And let me make sort of a point here. It's not only a consumer. It's not only a final consumer. It's also the user, right? So if you are producing feed, you are going to import corn that is an input into your production process. Well, you're also paying that tariff, right? So it's a user, either consumer or intermediate use. So that's the issue with retaliatory tariffs, that they are applied in a way that you can actually inflict pain on the country that you're fighting with. And that's why we see the type of retaliatory tariff that we see. They are on pretty particular spirits that belong to one part of the country, or agriculture, soybeans with corn, etc. So those are the ones that for agriculture in the U.S. matter quite a bit.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
New Senate budget resolution. Functionally, another $8.5 trillion in deficit.
Chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Council from Arizona, David Schweikert.
So here's extending the tax cuts in 2017, and then they made a margin there for additional spending. Either it be some of the other priorities, no tax on tips, no tax on overtimes, those things. And then we have another $520 billion in additional spending. But can you see this line here? You can't really see it. It's $3 billion of cuts. That's what they put onto their budget resolution. If we borrow $6 billion a day and their budget resolution is actually, apparently a little more than $6 billion. It's 10, 12 hours of borrowing for an entire year. And this is for a 10-year budget. That's what they gave us. Oh, but David, when you guys start to negotiate, you'll actually fill it in. Except we're negotiating. We put $1.5 trillion of savings and with hope getting to two, and they give us $3 billion. Remember, $1 trillion's $1,000 billion. And you wonder why some of us are cranky. You know, when our colleagues down the hall give us basically crap to work with. So let's actually start to walk through what this actually means to us as a body. When we finished the last budget year, we were $28 trillion of publicly held debt. That's the debt we have to sell. When you hear someone say $37 trillion of debt, remember, there's a portion of that we borrow internally. We reach into trust funds and other things. We borrow the money there. We pay interest on it. Anyone says, oh, you borrowed my Social Security money. Yes, and you got paid actually a pretty good interest rate back. But here's the baseline. Now, remember, why is this not $22 trillion? Because they were using a 2034 number. That's, we caught them playing a game there. Then add another $6.9 trillion on top of that, and what do you get? Well, here's what you get. Functionally, when we all got elected this last November, United States sovereign debt was around $28 trillion. When we finish this 10-year cycle, we're going to add another $28 trillion if we do what the Senate sent us. What took us 240 years to build up, we're going to double in the next 9 budget years, next 10 calendar years. Go team! That's the morality of this place. But it's hard, David, to explain to people that we need to modernize. We need to change the way we deliver services. We need to use technology. And some programs we should just stop because they've been outdated for decades. This is important here. This is without any of the disaster aid. This is without the economic potential slowdown. And so tax receipts coming down. This is without a war, just using actually what were optimistic numbers of the next 10 years tax receipts. And what we're talking about right now doing is over the next 10 years doubling what took us 240 years to build up in debt. Does anyone care about your retirement? Does anyone have kids? Think of this. It may be insane, and my wife's my age. I have a 9-year-old daughter and a functionally two-and-a-half-year-old little boy we've adopted. And yes, they're brother and sister, so that explains. When my little boy is functionally 24, 25 years old, every tax in the United States, every tax has to double just to maintain baseline services. The morality of we are raising kids that would be part of the first generation to be structurally poorer than their parents because when you borrow money, it is a tax. It just means you're going to let someone else pay it with interest. It's not free money. It's a tax.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Who am I talking to?
Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala is Director General of the World Trade Organization. Talks about meeting with the U.S.
3 weeks ago, is it 3 or 4 weeks? 4 weeks ago, I met with Ambassador Greer and with Secretary Lutnick. So those are the people in the administration that I have been in touch with. And I had, I must say, good meetings with them. This was before the reciprocal tariffs came out, and we were still waiting for them. And I think those are my primary contacts, in particular Ambassador Greer, the USTR's office.
Some have said the World Trade Organization is no longer effective, but she says the dispute process is intact.
What is paralyzed is an appellate body. Many don't realize it. The dispute settlement system actually is working. And I want to, so the idea that the dispute settlement system is paralyzed is not true. We are getting more and more disputes. I wish I'd remembered to bring the statistics, but maybe someone can bring it to me quickly. Because I think that at the moment there are 41 disputes that have been brought. And we are seeing more settlement of disputes in a more cooperative fashion now than before. So members are sending the message that yes, they still see the WTO as a place to bring disputes, and we have new disputes that have been brought on regarding this particular situation we're in. They continue to come in. That's first point. I think second point I want to emphasize is that one of the criticisms the U.S. made about the dispute settlement system was it was becoming too legalistic. And some of the thinking that disputes could be settled in a more cooperative manner, that the WTO would provide a platform for, that was being lost. I'm happy to tell you that more of that is actually happening now. And many of these disputes are being settled. Members table a dispute and call for consultations in order to discuss it and try to resolve the problems. And very often they manage to do that. So, yes, the place is seen as a place to bring your and it is happening. That's my answer.
She took questions from reporters.
Very much. Stéphane Bissard, Le Temps newspaper. As you know, a Republican congressman tabled a proposal asking the Trump administration to withdraw from WTO. And I was wondering, is the U.S. still on board? And if not, how will WTO move forward? Thank you.
Well, this tabling of this request is nothing new. I'm sure many of you know that with the U.S. Congress, every 5 years, they vote on whether to stay within the WTO or to leave. So this is nothing new. It just so happens that this is the fifth year, 2025, and it's, you know, it happened in 2020. It happened, it's happening at a time when we have all this, but it is nothing new. That is why what I want to explain. So we will wait and see what happens this time around. I have not had any signal from the U.S. Up till now about its position in the WTO. What they've told me is that they're sending, or told us, I should say, they've told members that they're sending an ambassador, one of their best, Ambassador Joseph Balloon. He's yet to be confirmed by the Senate. So I hope as soon as it's confirmed, we will have him here.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Historically, they were a significant source of government revenue, particularly before we had domestic income and consumption taxes.
Nelson Valoria is an ag economics professor at Kansas State.
1920, 1910, you could say that import tariff were 50-60% of government revenue. They are 2% now. We didn't have income taxes back then. And this is something that has happened globally. Some countries tax income, other countries tax consumption. So you pay a sales tax and a value-added tax, and that's what the government is receiving. So that's sort of the historical precedent for that. For some nations, nowadays, they remain relevant, and taxes go both ways. So you can tax consumption, you tax imports, and so tariffs are a source of government revenue. But if you are a country that produces a lot of corn, say Argentina, they tax their exports. So farmers pay a tax to the government before exporting, and that's a way that the government creates revenue. So it's an income tax, but based on the product, okay? Nowadays, however, tariffs are pretty much for protection, and again, the idea is to shield domestic industries for foreign competition. You are basically, well, I'm not going to import that much, I'm going to import less, that will increase my prices. And basically, when you put tariff, you make domestically produced alternative more attractive. And this is the argument of, you know, tariff create jobs. Well, basically, or tariff will bring manufacturers back. Well, because now it's more expensive to buy them abroad than here, so that would be the logic there. So, you know, local employment. Many countries have used tariff to, well, you know, foster infant industries. If you think about a country, countries in South America, or just to put an example, but this happened as well in Asia, all over the place, and in the U.S. in some point, you want to have aircraft, an aircraft industry. That's a highly competitive industry. It's super expensive just to get it started and to develop the technology. So some countries have decided to highly protect that industry. It's an infant industry, under the theory that in some point it'll grow up, and you won't have to protect it anymore. Sometimes work, sometimes it doesn't work. Or to facilitate what economists would call import substitution industrialization. So these were policies that were pretty popular in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and we are seeing them again in many places. Tariff can also be used strategically to correct real or perceived trade imbalances. We have what we call anti-dumping, when you suspect that a country is producing below production cost. It's selling in international markets below production cost. It's dumping stuff in the market. You can have anti-dumping tariff. You could also counteract foreign export subsidies. If I have the suspicion that my competitor is subsidizing under the cover of dark a product and that's making it more competitive, I could put a tariff on that. Or also to respond to currency manipulation. If I have evidence that a country is lowering their exchange rate to make their exports more competitive, I could put a tax. So those are some of the reasons they are used. And they also can serve as a broader political leverage for over other trading partners. When you, particularly when we're talking about industries that are, you know, considered national security, for example, to have some leverage on the way that on protection.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're dealing with seasonality. We've had, for instance, in the corn market, some strength. When you look at for the May contract, we've traded up as high as just about 520, closed at 482 and a fourth. I had been as low in the last 2 months as about 460.
Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain marketing economist, looks at the current market situation.
So I think most farmers take that run up from about 420 or so that happened in early March up to the high of about 490 as something very, very positive. And I know the upfront contract jumped up again to 490, but the futures, they were for corn futures, we had dropped below 450 for a little bit. Now we're up to about 466 on Thursday's close, so some positive there. I would say for soybeans, we also had some movement in the soybean market. We had dropped down to about a low of about 975 or so within the last several weeks, but have ended up and come up to a little bit below 975. Closed yesterday at 1036 and a half, had been about the 1050 within the last period of time here. When you look back in the history during this calendar year so far May contract for soybeans, we've gotten up to as high as about $11.11. So again, seasonality coming into play. We got some pretty good export demand, some worries about weather, et cetera, and maybe we'll talk about those later, but you do have that in play. And then there's wheat, Kansas hard red winter wheat futures. We've been kind of in this blocky sideways pattern trading to the high side, had gotten as low as about 550 for the May contract here within the last month and a half or so. And again, closed at about yesterday by 557, had been a little bit higher than that of late. So it just seems not uncommon now to see in the wheat market, gosh, 10 cents up over here, 10 cents or more down below over there, and just kind of a volatile place. And weather will come into play pretty strongly now for the next several months here. We're in April in hard red winter wheat country. Well, the weather for the second half, last half of April on into May, June is just prime time in terms of what we actually get for yields. And it looks pretty dry right now for the last 7 days, but we'll see where all that goes. And again, we can talk about that later. So lots going on. I would say that when you look at the markets and kind of look at the carries and try to see what signals are giving farmers or agribusiness, you do really see some strong carries in the wheat market from July to May, about 6 cents a bushel a month, 7 cents July to September, 7 cents, almost 8 September to December, 6 again in March. So it really seems like a situation where the markets are pushing wheat out to the future, giving large carries, encouraging people to store. And farmers, typically, we have many storage hedgers that take advantage of that. They'll look at the carry and think that that's more of a speculative situation to maybe take advantage of. But boy, the grain processors, the elevators, they look at those carries and they see money there. So again, we're, I guess we're in these situations again this year where where do farmers, when they get the crop out, and if they do see carries, do we do something in terms of storage hedges or forward contract hedges, et cetera, if they get a good forward contract bid, that would give them some profitability. We don't typically do that, but in this market, given this uncertainty, it might be something to consider.
Kansas State grain marketing economist Dan O'Brien. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Still lower cattle inventory year over year, per USDA's April cattle on feed report, yet continued signs of attempted inventory buildup. This is livestock analyst Anthony Fisher.
The number of cattle on feed in feedlots on April 1st was 11.64 million head. This was about 2% below a year ago. The report showed an increase in placements, which was within the range that industry analysts were expecting. The number of cattle placed in feedlots was about 1.84 million head, which was about 5% above 2024.
Marketings of fed cattle also represented a 1% increase from this time last year.
It's worth noting that April also gives us a breakout of cattle on feed for heifers and steers. On April 1st, there were 4.38 million head of heifers and heifer calves on feed, which was about 4% below a year ago.
With a lower percentage of heifer and heifer calves making up the total cattle and feedlot population than 1 year ago. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.